A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, I thought we'd seen the last of Manic Monday, and then we had all that rain in Cincinnati, and we had something that Matt Roberts has coined Wild Wednesday. Matt, tell us about Wild Wednesday. What went on?
Yeah, I should say I tweeted that from my bed, having just woken up. Not a lot of thought went into the naming process. But
I thought you'd come up with this amazing thing.
I just needed a synonym for manic that was with a W and came up with wild. So Wild Wednesday.
If you'll remember, I actually started this game on the podcast at Wimbledon. You weren't such a fan of it then, David.
I didn't say I was really a fan of it. But anyway, carry on, Matt. What happened?
Well, what happened was yesterday in Cincinnati, there were just incredible matches everywhere because, as you said, rain on Tuesday, I think, just put them behind schedule and they had to make up some time. So they started at 10 o'clock in the morning in Cincinnati. Bublik was not a fan of that. He was yawning through his match against Dimitrov.
Hard relate, yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And they finished long into the night. There was 7 matches on one court yesterday in Cincinnati. It was very reminiscent of Manic Monday. And normally I find it really stressful, but this was kind of like an unexpected bonus and all quite fun, I thought.
Yeah, it was so busy that I started doing pole vaults at about 7 a.m. and I ran out of time to get them all in. I mean, there were so many amazing matches going on, including Paula Badosa against Arina Sabalenka, which ended 7-6 in the third. This is what kept happening, is just amazing matches ended up with results that I'm thinking, well, but I want to see that, and I can't, because it's on at the same time as this and that. I don't know.
Which is a very Manic Monday feeling, isn't it?
They've definitely made the right decision getting rid of this, because, I don't know, I found yesterday immensely frustrating because it was too good everywhere, and that's not on.
Yeah, I mean, you were also at the Hawthorns.
No, that was a different time of the day. That's about right. Yeah, I was watching the Albion.
It was at peak time, David.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, they should be planning the tennis matches around my football watching schedule. Goodness sake.
I mean, I think the problem with Manic Monday is they scheduled it like that, and that's a conscious decision they're making. This was making up for rain, so I have a sort of hard time criticising them for it, because it was kind of had to be done, otherwise they would have been just completely behind schedule. But I get what you mean. When there's so many great matches on at once, it is frustrating. But I imagine for grounds pass holders, it was like a sort of dream day. There was just so many good matches, even on outside courts.
What you mean I've got to think about other people? Right.
It's fun being a grounds pass holder in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
If it's not unbearably hot, then it's a really...
Or raining.
Or raining. It's a really fun tournament. They're sponsored. One of their sponsors is a local ice cream company, and it's memorable ice cream. I still think about it quite a lot.
When did you go to Cincinnati?
5 years ago, something like that.
Did you dangle off any buildings at that one or
well,
not?
Well, Cincinnati is the one, the event situated next door to the best theme park I've ever attended, of course. And yes, I was there for the whole week covering it for radio. And I've told my Cincinnati tales on this podcast before. I was staying in the Great Wolf Lodge, which was a sort of holiday hotel adjacent to the theme park, and I slept in bunk beds shaped like wolves.
No, you haven't told the story before.
I've never heard that before.
And yes, on finals day, I'd been hankering after the theme park all week, because you can see the rides in the background in the tennis center. I could see people going down Dragon's Mouth or whatever it was, and I was just enviously staring. Anyway, finals day, my friend and I, she works for the ATP. Everybody needs a friend that's prepared to, as an adult, go to a theme park with you. We paid for those. So the final was at some, the men's final was at something like 4 p.m. in the afternoon. So I was like, right, got about 6 hours here. We paid for those skip the queue passes. They weren't cheap. Yeah, spent 6 hours just going round and round on all the rides. Flew to New York the next day for the US Open and spent 2 days in bed with whiplash upon arrival.
What? Shouldn't laugh about that, but it's quite funny. Mm. So we've had Catherine in Cincinnati relived. Who thought it? But that's what we've had. Right, well, we better talk about some of the tennis. It's slightly tricky talking about the tennis because we're recording this before Thursday's day of play, which means we're in grave danger of talking about the exciting performances of players who are going to have lost by the time you all listen to this. So I'm going to try and find ways around that. What I'm going to do first is just talk about Naomi Osaka's tennis, and then we'll talk about her press conference appearances and the things she's been saying and the things that have been happening. But let's just talk very quickly about the first tennis that we've seen from her since the Olympics, when she lost in, what was it, the second match she played at the Olympics. But here, yesterday, against Coco Gauff, she was really good. I mean, it was close, wasn't it? Gauff got into a set and a break lead, from what I understand. I was watching football, but maybe one of you two know about what went on. But it was a comeback. And actually, from what I was reading from, I think, Chris Clary's piece in the New York Times on Naomi Osaka, she suddenly went into serve overdrive and just rolled through that deciding set. But that looks like a rivalry in the making. I think Osaka is as excited about the prospect as anybody.
Yeah, it was their third meeting and they'd split the previous two, and both of those had been straight set matches and relatively comfortable wins for Osaka at the US Open and then Gauff at the Australian Open. And so this was their first three-setter. It was a good match. It was tough conditions. It was really windy during the couple of hours they were playing. And absolutely, as you said, Osaka had quite a slow start, a set and a breakdown, not playing very well, but then suddenly shifted gears and really did start playing well and took over and played as kind of as we know she can. I'm not worried when I see Naomi Osaka not playing that well in the first set, because we know the incredible level of tennis she can play. It's just nice to see her back on court. It's nice to see her finding something in the second half of this match. And it was kind of a win which Osaka's had a lot in her career, where, you know, I think all of her slam wins, there's been a win along the way where she's really had to fight for it, where she's been down. And it's kind of a defining trait of hers to win some matches that you don't expect her to win. And this was one, probably, from a set and a breakdown. And yeah, I thought overall a good match and a good performance, and certainly a rivalry, nice rivalry developing between them.
Yeah, the rivalry developing is a really nice little sub storyline to that matchup, because, you know, aside from kind of Barty Sabalenka, which we're really pushing, rivalries is the only aspect of the kind of WTA Avengers that has disappointed a bit over the last 18 months. They haven't quite emerged in, for various different reasons, in the way that we would have wanted. And I really think Osaka and Goff is the real deal. And we'll be seeing it lots, hopefully.
Now, there were a lot of headlines before this match even took place, which you may have come across. You may have been hearing about this story. We're just going to briefly run through what went on, and then we'll talk about our reactions to it. And this is Naomi Osaka meeting the tennis press, probably for the first time, I would say, since her decision not to face the tennis media or the media in general in Paris. Now, she did speak briefly following her Olympics defeat in the mixed zone, which is a little area the players walk through at the Olympics on the way back to the locker room, which is different to the more official and formal setting of a press conference, which is what we tend to have at tennis tournaments. Before the event in Cincinnati, she did attend the pre-event press conference, which most of the top players do. They're requested, and that's something that tends to happen, and it still happened in her case. Our attention was alerted to, I wasn't actually in the press conference, but I was alerted to some tweets from colleague Ben Rothenberg, who was in that press conference, and who reported that there'd been a series of questions which had ended up with Naomi Osaka in tears, having to stop the press conference for 5 minutes and then coming back in to complete it. Since gone back and actually looked at the transcript of what went on, and it was a journalist called Paul Doherty of the Cincinnati Inquirer. This is what he'd said to Osaka midway through this press conference. He said, "You're not crazy about dealing with us, especially in this format, yet you've a lot of outside interests that are served by having a media platform. I guess my question is, how do you balance the two?" And he then asked a supplementary question about what she might have said to Simone Biles, who you may remember was reporting at the Olympics that or pulling out of events at the Olympics because she needed some time away from it all. Naomi Osaka replied, "When you say I'm not crazy about dealing with you guys, what does that refer to?" He followed up and he said, "Well, you've said you don't especially like the press conference format, yet that seems to be obviously the most widely used means of communication to the media and through the media to the public." She thought on that for a while. She said, "That's interesting. I would say the occasion when to do the press conference is what I feel is the most difficult." And she thought on it some more. The moderator who was there offered for her to move on to the next question, which she declined. She said, "No, I'm actually very interested in that point of view. So could you repeat the question?" Which he tried to do. And she gave an answer, which is quite interesting. She said, I can't really speak for everybody. But ever since I was younger, I've had a lot of media interest on me. I think it's because of my background as well as the way I play. Because in the first place, I'm a tennis player. That's why a lot of people are interested in me." And she gave a very thoughtful answer. And then when she got to the end of it, she said, "But I'd like to say I'm not really sure how to balance the two. I'm figuring it out at the same time as you are, I would say." And at that point, she became emotional and she looked up to the ceiling. She tried to pull her cap over her eyes and she was in tears as the next questions were asked. And at that point, they stopped the press conference. Now, shortly after that, we saw a statement on Ben Rothenberg's Twitter feed from Naomi Osaka's agent, Stuart Duguid. And the statement read as follows: "The bully at the Cincinnati Inquirer is the epitome of why player media relations are so fraught right now. Everyone on that Zoom will agree that his tone was all wrong and his sole purpose was to intimidate. Really appalling behaviour. And this insinuation that Naomi owes her off-court success to the media is a myth. Don't be so self-indulgent." Well, that then kicked off and created headlines all over the world, and there were various thought pieces written, columns written about both the approach of the journalist and the questions asked, the reaction to them from Naomi Osaka, and that statement from Osaka's agent, which I have to say, I personally don't agree with his version of events there. I've seen the exchange. I think that the questions asked by the journalists were fair, and I thought the tone that they were asked in was maybe not how we in the tennis media, I don't think I would have asked it in quite the same way, because I'm really aware of what's been going on, and also maybe I just have a different tone generally. But I also don't think he was asking them in a really intimidatory way. Certainly I didn't find there was any intent to get a reaction or to upset. I didn't think that that's what was going on. What did you think?
Yeah, I entirely agree with you, David. I think the only misstep here really is the statement from Naomi Osaka's agent. I think the question was legitimate from the journalist. I think he did a very good job of clarifying himself. I didn't find it to be aggressively toned. It wasn't perhaps exactly as you say, it wasn't perhaps toned the way a journalist really familiar with her from the tennis media might have phrased it, but it certainly wasn't aggressive or intimidating. I think the moderator handled it very well, giving Naomi the option to move on to the next question, because she looked like she might have wanted to, but actually Naomi said, no, I'm interested in this. I want to answer it, and I want to think on that point of view. And the agent, and I was impressed with that from Osaka, you know, the curiosity in her, the not wanting to just deflect. I mean, maybe it would actually be better for her to develop a means of just deflecting these questions in press, but it's so, she so wants to be open, I think, and she so wants to be authentic, and that's a great credit to her. I think her agent statement actually does her a real disservice. It was really difficult to watch her getting upset like that. But the upset is clearly just there beneath the surface. The whatever it is, the sadness, the anxiety, the stress is clearly there to be triggered. And I want her to be helped with that, and I want her to be okay. But I don't think that journalist's question was the ultimate reason why she became upset in that press conference. I don't know what the solution is for Naomi Osaka to get into a better place mentally and emotionally. She might just need to, might just be time. She might just need to keep playing, keep thinking on things, keep figuring things out. She might need some, might be best for her to take some time away from the game, as people are expecting. I have no idea what's best for her. I just want her to have all the help and support that she needs to get there. But I think there is some extremely unnuanced discussion around what happened that's really unhelpful, and some of the headlines you see as a result of, you know, hot takes from it all are particularly unhelpful to Osaka ultimately, and I think we all just want Osaka to be okay, because Osaka being okay makes tennis more okay, because she's such a tremendous asset to tennis, and it's wonderful to see her back playing.
I'm going to ask Matt's view or version of events of what followed the Coco Gauff match in a moment, but also, Catherine, I think it once again raises the question over because that's what we all want. We want Naomi Osaka to be okay, to not be suffering, to be able to play the sport that she wants to play and to give everybody the benefit of her brilliance as a tennis player and her captivating personality and difference and everything she gives as a human being, because she's wonderful in so many ways. And somehow we need to arrive at a position where that's what we get without her feeling terrible. I've been thinking about this a lot. Do we need to change some things in how we run this sport? Or I say we, but how the sport is run and how people like us in the media are dealt with. Do we need to have some flexibility, some variety, so that rather than just trying to cram every player into a one-size-fits-all press conference and this is how it's done, for everybody, maybe that does need to be some variety to all of this.
Quite possibly. And I definitely think opening the channels of communication and discussion and debate about that would be extremely welcome. I haven't heard any proposals of a framework, a new system that would work better than the existing one. I certainly don't have one to propose to you. But then all the more reason for discussion and batting ideas around. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that it would be extremely arrogant and complacent to suggest that there is no better way of doing things than what we currently have. But yeah, to characterise it as what was the exact wording that Stuart Dugard used to characterise the relationship, that why player media relations are so fraught right now? Well, I don't think that's an accurate characterisation of the situation. As I've just said, yeah, I'm sure there could be some improvements, some enhancements. There could be some from the media side as well, but a statement like that creates an even more adversarial tone to the situation, and you know, it does make it seem media versus player. That's how that statement reads to me, and that is deeply unhelpful. That adds to the problem, or the perceived problem, in my view.
And that's not how she's absolutely not. She's
almost a victim of her own desire to be open and authentic, and we love her for that. But you know that most top level sports people have developed a defense mechanism in press, haven't they? To, you know, it's like politicians have to instead of actually answering the question you've asked, to answer the question that you want to answer, to deflect away the questions that probe into somewhere that you don't want to go emotionally or mentally. And she doesn't ever resort to those things. And maybe it's just not in her to do that, or maybe she's sort of purposefully resisting doing that. But, you know, it's she wants to have a good relationship with the press. And maybe things need to change in order for that to be the case going forward. But, you know, lighting a fire under arguments that, or perceptions that it's an adversarial system is unhelpful.
Just to say, that topic of whether there could be some change in how press conferences are run was brought up in this Naomi Osaka pre-tournament press conference in one of the initial questions before everything happened that you've just relayed. And look, she said, I don't know the requirements of the press, so you know I'm saying this, but I'm understanding that I'm not speaking from your point of view, but from my point of view as a player, perhaps we could have, I think she used the term, like a sick day or something, just like a maybe once in a while, just a free pass, just to say, look, I don't feel like doing press today, and maybe I could reply to some questions in an email or something like that. And they can do that. You know, Osaka could skip a press conference, but she would be fined for it, which is quite aggressive, I do think, fining someone for not doing a press conference. I think, you know, that's an interesting suggestion. You know, a pass every once in a while, I think she's sort of opened the conversation there, and hopefully it will go forward.
We could call it a Venus if we wanted a fun name for it.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. I mean, I don't find email exchanges typically that helpful, but each player is different. Some people come alive in a different format, and that's why I don't want to close the door and just say, no, you need to come in front of all of us. And I mean, the other thing that I've seen happen in the past is journalists as a group saying, well, listen, why don't we just send one of us in armed with the questions and just have a one-to-one for a bit, you know? And that does happen. I think it gets lost a little bit that journalists and the media generally are not flexible. Well, that's not the case. Very often the media will try to work with the officials and with the player to get something that gives them content, but also isn't going to put a player through an awful experience. They're not ogres.
I would also say it's harder for everybody at the moment doing this stuff over Zoom. I mean, the system is as good as it can be remotely. And I think we're all very grateful to, you know, to the communications operators that have made that possible and streamlined the system over the course of the last 18 months. But building up a rapport, judging a tone, judging a mood, you know, picking up on a line of questioning, you know, asking follow-ups. All of that is extremely difficult. A lot of the time in these Zooms, you're having to submit your question in advance. So you can't really be responsive to the situation, or you have to put your hand up, you know, and alert that you've got a question well in advance. It's a lot harder to be sensitive to the moment and the mood. And I'm sure that goes both ways, but of course, we can only speak of it from a journalist point of view. So it's suboptimal for us too. And yeah, absolutely. Let's open a discourse about. Let's have a what would they do in Parliament? You'd have a focus group.
Can we just get on the pub?
A tennis Maybe. Focus group with players on it and journalists and agents and ATP, WTA people.
Good idea.
And we could have meetings about having meetings.
Matt, what happened after the Coco Gauff match? Because Osaka did a press conference then as well, didn't she?
She did, yes. And on the court, she had said how she's sort of changed her mindset. And, you know, she said she was pleased to win. But honestly, with everything going on in the world, and she came out onto the court wearing a Haitian mask, and you know, she said just waking up in the morning at the moment feels a lot like a win. And you know, I think that's quite a big insight into how she's feeling, how she feels the effects of everything that is going on in the world. And she was asked about that comment in her press conference. And it became a more general discussion about her decision not to do media at the French Open. And she said, yeah, I wondered what affected me and made me not want to do media. I'm wondering if I was scared because sometimes I would see headlines of players losing. And then the headline the next day would be like a collapse or they're not that great anymore. She said the choice to go out there and play, to go see fans, the people that are coming out and watching you play, that itself is an accomplishment. And I'm not sure when along the way I started desensitizing that. It started not being an accomplishment for me, so I felt like I was very ungrateful on that fact. And look, those are the sort of thoughtful, interesting answers that Naomi Osaka gives in her press conferences. And I've been thinking about this, and you mentioned Simone Biles earlier, and it strikes me that there is a similarity in what they're both saying. I, having watched the Naomi Osaka documentary, there's a line in there where she says, "What am I if I'm not a successful tennis player?" And something Simone Biles tweeted during the Olympics was, "I never felt like I was defined by anything other than my gymnastics." And it strikes me that those are very similar statements. And you know, it made me think of a lot of the retired athletes and tennis players who struggled to come to terms with the fact that their tennis playing career or their sporting career is over, because that's sort of all they've ever known. And I think Biles and Osaka are saying they don't want to be completely defined by that. They don't want to be completely defined by winning, by success, by medals as well. They want different purposes in life. And look, I think that's probably very, very healthy, hopefully, both in the short term and also in the long term later in their life. I think these are interesting conversations. You know, we just sort of hope for her sake, and all the fans in tennis hope for their sake as well, that Osaka can, exactly as you've both said, get the help and support she needs at the moment.
Yeah, quite right. Well, she now faces Jill Teichman in the next round, which probably already know the result of that. Sorry, listening to this. But anyway, we will discuss what else happens results-wise involving Naomi Osaka at the end of the tournament in our show on Sunday night or Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently: Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Lots more tennis to discuss, but first a bit of bad news. Big bad news, really, with Dominic Thiem out for the season. And I just found this... I knew this was coming, and yet it still hit me hard, Catherine. I don't quite know why. I think the moment that I heard it, I wanted to seek out a little montage of Dominic Thiem's greatest hits to remind me of how good he is and how much fun he is and how exhilarating he is. Because we haven't seen that side of Dominic Thiem since he won the US Open, in all honesty. He had a difficult time coming to terms and with it and bouncing back as a tennis player. He seemed to hit the wall. And then he had this horrible wrist injury. And he says, the past 6 weeks I've been following medical advice, wearing the wrist splint, doing exercise to stay in shape before starting to train back on court. My recovery was going really well, but then last week I hit a ball during training and started to feel some pain again. I went straight to the doctors, had some tests. They said my wrist needs more time, so we've all agreed on being really conservative, which I think is a good move. He says, I'll wear the wrist splint for a couple more weeks before starting with exercises and then training with the racket again. But Catherine, the fact and the thought of Dominic Thiem not defending his US Open title when fans are back, that's such a shame.
Yeah, he's joining the Juan Martin Del Potro wrist injury support group as we speak. Same actually, David. It was absolutely no surprise at all. I mean, it was only a few weeks ago that we saw that video of him having to play tennis left-handed. You know, that's how far along in his recovery process he is with that right wrist. So, of course, it's no great surprise. And if anything, it's a relief, because I didn't want to see him struggle back out there just to make an appearance at the US Open in order to, you know, tick the box of defending his title. Because Dominic Thiem being a shadow of himself is no fun at all. We've seen, you know, he can get beaten quite handily, actually, with his game being, you know, a few percent underpowered, which it inevitably would have been. And yet still, I was really saddened and shocked by it. I mean, exactly as you say, it will have been a year. It's going to have been a lot more than a year since we saw Dominic Thiem playing the sort of tennis that makes us gasp. And he's a real loss to the tour, I think, more than I had realised. I think I felt it last week in Canada. You know, when a couple of the top players lost, the men's draw suddenly felt a bit bare.
He used to be so reliable, wasn't
exactly,
he?
Exactly, you know? Yeah. I suddenly sort of looked at it and thought, well, who's missing here? You know, obviously Djokovic and Nadal are missing. Obviously Federer is missing, but it feels like more than that. And it took me a few moments to go, God, Dominic Thiem. You know, he just would have been there. And it was exciting watching him figure out the hard courts. It was really good fun. Yeah, he's a real loss. I really miss his feet off the ground, single-handed, in-to-out backhand winners, and I hope they return to all of our lives soon.
Well, Matt and I are going to work on sourcing the most complete montage of those shots from his career, and we're going to gift wrap them for you, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
Yes, yeah. We might slip a Denis Shapovalov one in there as well. And
yeah.
Yep, here for that.
That'll make you feel other things.
Maybe we can just drop a little Matt Roberts two-hander version. Mm-hmm. As well, you know. Yeah.
Is it Matt Roberts? Is it Marcelo Rios? Who can tell? You
know, it's very difficult. Simona Halep, by the way, another player with a great backhand, has withdrawn from Cincinnati. She beat Magda Linette and was all smiles after it, but she had what was reported as a small tear in her right adductor and has decided to pull out that tournament. I think probably precautionary more than anything in this instance, not like the injury she sustained in Rome and ended up missing French Open and Wimbledon. She says she'll rest up, do everything she can to be ready for the US Open. I really hope so. I really hope that this is nothing major as a setback, because again, a little bit like Thiem, she's just one of those massive value adders to any tournament. You care. You can't watch Simona Halep matches without caring. I don't know quite how she does it, but that is something she's got going for her as a tennis player. So get well soon, Simona. Let's have a little look at the women's draw and see where we're up to as we talk to you right now. Ash Barty got a win against Heather Watson. Now faces the defending champion Victoria Azarenka. Blimey. I'm just going to do a lot of yes pleasing here. Let's just get
I'll leave that in your hands.
I heard Ash Barty's press conference before the tournament, and it was all about the Olympics. It was so funny because obviously, as you've described, it was just a mix zone in the Olympics. So I think a lot of journalists, you know, probably weren't in Tokyo and didn't get to ask Barty the questions they would have liked to have asked her. And gosh, she seems refreshed and rejuvenated having been to the Olympics. She was talking about just how nice it was to have been around Australian accents in the village, because, you know, she's not been home for so long and she's just had her little team with her, but just to see other Australians and to be in that environment. And this is going to be one of her, I think, favourite tennis memories, winning that bronze medal in the mixed doubles with John Pearce. I hadn't realised that they're really quite close friends and have really been targeting that medal together for quite a while. And you know, it wasn't just a supplementary doubles to the singles. It was a real, look, I just want to win a medal for Australia. It doesn't matter which discipline it's in. It was just the sort of perfect Olympics approach from Ash Barty, and she loved it. And yeah, she played Heather Watson, and look, she was a bit rusty. I don't think she loves the conditions in Cincinnati, but, you know, got through and hopefully can build in this tournament.
You've picked Barbora Krejcikova to win the title. You had a sort of a momentary thought on Ash Barty, didn't you, Matt? And then you just immediately decided, actually, no, I'm going to go for the killer, Krejcikova.
Is that a new nickname?
Well, that's just what she seems to be to me, that she's just come in and suddenly thought, oh, singles. Okay, I'll have a go at that. Just beat everybody for months on end. But anyway, you've gone for her to do exactly that this tournament. Beat Diana Yastremska. and now faces Garbiñe Muguruza. Blimey, Riley, that sounds good.
Yep. Will have been played by the time this podcast goes out, so let's not dwell.
Let's get straight on to Angelique Kerber, who's going to snare me 1,510 points in the predictions competition, which Matt reckons will end the predictions competition when it happens. She's beaten Maria Sakkari and Alina Svitolina back to back. Is she going to do it? Are you, either of you worried?
I love seeing Kerber back in this type of form. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. I'm a little bit worried, but I think the most likely scenario is she does a Wimbledon. She'll run up against someone in the semi-finals or maybe even final. But a little bit worried.
She's in an incredible section of the draw where you've got Barty against Azarenka, Kerber against Ostapenko and Krejcikova against Muguruza. You know, six Grand Slam champions all next to each other in the draw. Just, you know, just as we were saying, the men's field without Djokovic and Nadal can very quickly feel quite bare if there are some losses. That just doesn't happen in these women's tournaments at the moment. And yeah, I mean, it's a very big win over Svitolina. I hadn't realised that she'd lost her last seven against Svitolina.
No, because it was 9-5, the head-to-head, wasn't it? But it's all turned around dramatically.
Yeah, totally. And yet, you know, when it really mattered, she was the more daring player. She was the one willing to go for it. And she came up with some great forehand winners in crucial stages of that match. And that was her first top 10 win in a completed match since Eastbourne of 2019.
Goodness.
She's really keeping up the form that she found on the grass a few months ago.
With Torben Belts as her coach, I think for the fourth time they're back together. It just works, guys. Stick with it. But she's doing me proud. But I should say the only reason I went for her to win the tournament was because Matt told me about how comfortably she dispatched Maria Sakkari, and I thought, right, I'll do it as a prediction. I was quite sad to see the state Jennifer Brady was in when she was forced to retire against Yelena Ostapenko. I mean, she looked in a bad way. Some sort of leg issue, I think. And
foot, I think.
Right. I mean, that she'd won the first set. She was 5-4 down in the second and then just couldn't go on. I mean, that really doesn't sound good, to be honest, ahead of the US Open to me. And she's had a few, hasn't she? She's had a few injuries now. I think maybe even the same injury, but just, you know, she just keeps getting stuff that's knocking her about. Get well soon, Jennifer Brady. Ons Jabeur beat Iga Świątek. Wow. And pretty straightforwardly, I think. It was about 3-3, which surprised me a bit. I know Świątek had been talking about her doubles. She'd been playing with Bethany Mattek-Sands to a full house. These draws are absolutely rammed with top big names.
It made me think back to their match at Wimbledon, because Jabeur beat Świątek then as well. So she's won their last two. And that was a three-setter at Wimbledon. But actually, it wasn't that close. I think Świątek grabbed the first set, suddenly raising her level. And then Jabeur just stormed through the second and third sets that day, and she did a similar thing last night. I just watched it back this morning, and my goodness, there's something about the way Świątek hits the ball that seems to go right into Jabeur's strike zone. She was just teeing off, just hitting winners galore. She's really in kind of breathtaking form at the moment, and you sort of just feel like she could be on the verge of something. And yet, as we spoke about in last week, there are just these little barriers that she needs to overcome. But her tennis is so, so good.
I'm going to use that one, Catherine, in the future. Could be on the verge of something.
It was very David Law, Matt.
I like that. So Jabeur now is on the verge of facing Petra Kvitova. So, you know, good luck with that one. Jessica Pegula is benefiting from the Halep withdrawal. So Pegula now faces Karolina Pliskova, who she's beaten four times out of four this year. So that's a good one. Paola Badosa, I mentioned earlier. She is two for two. She's won two matches in deciding set tiebreaks, including against Sabalenka in the previous round, and now faces Elena Rybakina, who got an absolutely smashing win against Lisa Mertens. I saw 3-2, I think that was. Karolina Muchová, this was another story that I noticed, was that Johanna Konta was a set up against Karolina Muchová and lost the second set tiebreak and lost in three. And the same happened to another British player, Cameron Norrie. I noticed he was a set up and ended up losing a second set tiebreak before losing his match. But Bianca Andreescu got absolutely dispatched by Muchová last night. Did you see any of that?
I did, yeah. And I also watched Konta Muchová, and I thought Konta was awesome in the first set. Just perfect Joe Konta tennis. You know, everything working. And then there was a rain delay, actually, when she was a set up. And I think that changed the course of that match. And Muchová found her form. And then she comprehensively outplayed Andreescu. It was quite something to see, actually. And thankfully, Andreescu didn't seem to have any physical issues. But that sort of made it all the more perplexing, really, because I kind of think of Andreescu's tennis as pretty much the best tennis when she's capable of playing it. But then I thought, well, she hasn't been able to play tennis sort of consecutively for such a long time because she keeps getting little setbacks. And I think she looked like a player still needing to find her form, whereas Muchová just looked like someone in absolute sort of peak form, you know, and she was the one conjuring up the brilliance when she really needed it, which is something you associate with Andreescu. I think it was kind of a real marker of just how tough things are for Andreescu at the moment. You know, she's got a lot of points to defend at the US Open and Indian Wells over the next couple of months. She didn't defend her Canada points either. I think she was the second seed in Canada, wasn't she? And she's the seventh seed here. Her ranking and her sort of place in tennis could look quite different if she doesn't find that form in the next few months, because she's nowhere near the player she was a couple of years ago, and yet I still believe she's capable.
It's in there.
She needs a run.
She doesn't need to worry about the ranking, in my view. I think the biggest problem is that the US Open and Indian Wells are coming up. She can't use those really to just get some form in, whereas I think what she could do with is some lower level tournaments, quite honestly, even if it was going down a completely different rung of events, just to get loads and loads of matches in.
Yeah, I can see that. Get wins, get matches, build confidence in your body. I do think that's a big thing from hearing, you know, pundits, ex-players talk about how, you know, when it feels like the injuries are piling up, or when the injuries, in fact, are piling up. You know, that reaction she had with the toe injury in Montreal, when she started sobbing in the chair, didn't she? And I don't think it was about the toe. It was about, oh my God, something else.
Yeah.
You know, Maria Balotelli, why always me vibes. And look, I would feel the same. I was thinking, why always you, Bianca? But I think she's lost confidence in her body, and that must affect how you move and the decisions you make on the court. And she needs to be an instinctive player, I think. She needs to not be second-guessing any of those decisions on the court. And I think the only way to overcome that is by doing it and winning and playing. So you could be onto something there, David.
Oh, who'd have thought it? Andy Murray looked like he might have been on something the other day when he won 6-4, 6-4 against Richard Gasquet, who's the guy who'd beat him in his first singles match back with a metal hip 2 years ago. Same place, same scoreline, but Murray turned the tables. He looked good in this match against Gasquet, and he looks good as well for a set, particularly against Hubert Hurkacz last night. Eventually ended up losing it 7-6, 6-2. But physically, Catherine, Murray looks better than he has in a while, I think it's fair to say. And there's a bit of news on his side with an addition to his team, who you know something about.
Well, his physio has been on his team for a while, but is usually a non-present member of the team.
What's his name?
His name is James Moore. He's also my physio. had an appointment with him on Tuesday. Now I know why that was cancelled. He's over in Cincinnati. doing a stellar job, it has to be said. I'm doing my exercises, James. See you in September.
late September.
I believe you found a bigger fish to fry. I thought Andy Murray looked really good in that Gasquet match and for a lot of the Hurkacz match as well. I think he's playing slightly differently. I think he is playing the way people have sort of been expecting him to start playing for the last couple of years, really. It definitely looked more aggressive to me. There was more beef on his serve, I thought, which was making a big difference, more cheap points. There was rust, definitely. He had either set points or opportunity. He had two set points against Hurkacz at the end of that first set and probably should have taken one of them. Just he had a ball to put away and played a rusty shot, I think, and there were a few incidences of that. But hey, rust is a way better reason to be losing matches than any of the other reasons that he's danced between for the last however long. So I thought really positive signs for Andy Murray.
I thought it was really encouraging, both his actual tennis, just, you know, passed the eye test compared to Wimbledon, where he was quite reactive, whereas here he was, you know, trying to call the shots, and as you said, he didn't look underpowered, whereas he had done before. And then just hearing him talk, you know, afterwards, he said, from a pain perspective in matches this week, I felt really good and better than I have done for a long time. And that makes practice easier as well, because I'm not waking up in the morning worried about being in pain. I'm just enjoying it all the more because I know what it feels like to wake up and be in pain. And, you know, just as you've described there, not taking those set points. He put that down to decision making. And he said he doesn't have a run of matches against top players to trust himself to make right decisions in the big moments. And he said the last time he did that was the end of 2019, when he played all those tournaments in Asia, and then he went to Antwerp and he ended up winning the thing because he was sort of match sharp and he just needs that back. And he said something interesting about whether to play next week in Winston-Salem. The concern he's got is that he thinks he might do too well and it might harm his preparations for the US Open.
Humble brag.
He said, I need matches, but if I play like this, I think I'm going to do really well in Winston-Salem, and that's going to hurt the US Open. But I mean, he's not spoken like that in a long time. That's coming from a place of confidence, really, in how he's playing, and that's great to hear, even if it is quite funny.
Got tickets on himself, that Andy Murray. No, quite right. It's just great to see him back and looking better than he has in a while, and certainly better than I expected him to. Other people that are still in the tournament, Daniil Medvedev, Alexander Zverev, Stefanos Tsitsipas, all through without dropping a set to this point. Medvedev now faces Grigor Dimitrov, who got a good win over Alexander Bublik. What's going on there?
He likes Cincinnati, doesn't he, Dimitrov?
Well, maybe this is it. Maybe this... Anyway, 500th career win for Gael Monfils against Alex de Minaur, who, incidentally, de Minaur had gone through a run. I looked this up. He'd gone through a run where he'd lost the consecutive sets as follows. 6-2, 6-1, 6-1, 6-love at one point in the last 3 weeks. He'd lost those sets, which really doesn't sound Alex de Minaur at all to me. But he lost the first set 6-love against, can't remember who now, but he came back and won the match. But then he's run into Monfils, who seems to be playing out of his mind at the moment. And just looks to be riding high and enjoying the circuit at the moment, which is lovely to see because he's had his troubles, hasn't he?
Mm. He said he feels 1,000 times better. Get on Monfils.
Great. Aww. Well...
It's great to hear.
He brings the good times. So it's lovely to
have him. I presume that's 1,000 times better than... I'm hoping the low point was that Australian Open press conference that made me cry.
Mm. Yes.
Oh, he seems like a lovely bloke, Gael Monfils, doesn't he?
Just, yeah.
100th career win for Casper Ruud against Riley Opelka.
Is that something we celebrate?
Well,
that feels like people that celebrate a 3-month anniversary.
Kind of well done, Casper.
Okay, what about this? He won a 6-love set against Riley Opelka.
Okay, that's more of a celebration. Yeah, throw him a party for that.
How does that happen?
I think Opelka might have been... I didn't see it, but tired.
Ruud now faces Diego Schwartzman, who we watched a few days ago beat Dan Evans in a wildly entertaining match, which I was really pleased for Evans' perspective that he made competitive, because he'd been getting beaten up by players in the matches before that.
He's struggled from having COVID, hasn't he? Tsitsipas, take note.
Yes, and Tsitsipas we should mention, because he has given his views on vaccines during this tournament. In his pre-tournament press conference, he said he would only get the vaccine if it was mandatory for the tour. He was then asked about it in Greek after his win over Seb Korda. These are quotes from SDNA. The COVID-19 vaccine has not been tested enough because it is new and has some side effects, says Tsitsipas. I know some people who've had them. I'm not against it. I just see no reason for someone in my age group to be vaccinated yet. For us young people, I think it's good to pass the virus because we'll build immunity. I don't see it as something bad. Right. Mm.
It's an astonishing and unforgivable level of arrogance and ignorance, and I'm hugely disappointed.
Mm. Yeah, well, I share your view.
Yeah, it's depressing. There's too many tennis players that have been saying stuff like that, and it's depressing.
Mm. Yeah, quite right.
I know other sports have high-profile people that have express similar views, but it feels like tennis has more somehow. Someone somewhere do a PhD thesis on why so many tennis players have anti-vax sentiments.
And somebody get Andy Murray to get them all in a room and talk to them collectively about it. Right. We will have more tennis podcasts coming your way over the next few weeks. Lots of them. Including US Open Relived, because we've decided on our two shows with the great help of our guest editors, Chris Albertley and James Meredith. And we're going to be covering Marat Safin and his run to the US Open crown in 2000. Cannot wait to do that. Everybody who witnessed Safin play has thoughts, stories to tell, and we're going to be trying to tell as many of them as we can. He won the crown in 2000, beating Pete Sampras in the final. And we're going to cover the 2015 victory for Roberta Vinci over Serena Williams, stopping her pursuit of the Grand Slam, the calendar year Grand Slam in 2015. So those are the two stories we'll cover on US Open Relived. We're also going to be talking to our good friend Chris Clary of the New York Times, who's got a book coming out next week entitled The Master, which is basically the Roger Federer story through his experiences interviewing him, I think, around more than a dozen times over the last 20 years plus. It's a fantastic book. I've read it. Matt's read it, and we're going to get to talk to Chris for a show that we're going to be putting out early next week as well. And we're going to be back with you to tell you all about Cincinnati on Monday. We've got daily editions of the Tennis Podcast throughout the US Open. We're going to have Hannah back with us on Twitter. Can't wait. We're going to have a US Open draw preview. Don't look so worried, guys. We're going to be able to do it. I've got loads of energy after my holiday.
David's high on vitamin D, everyone.
Yeah. It's annoying. Holiday and the West Brom win is a combination.
Toxic or intoxicating.
Intoxicating, yes, right. Quite right. Okay. And we've got, Catherine, cheer yourself up with looking at the picture of Wilhelm.
Oh, I have many times this week already.
the Bernese Mountain Dog, who is magnificence personified. And you've seen a picture of him if you subscribe to our newsletter. If you don't, what are you doing? Scan down in your show notes and click on subscribe on our newsletter immediately. And then you'll be able to get there. Yeah, nearly. And we'll put a picture of Wilhelm on our social media for all of you stragglers who haven't got around to it yet. So, you know, you can go and see it there. Zeus is Catherine's mascot. Scouse and Mousel is Matt's. Mine is Rogue. And we're going for it big time, Rogue, with Angelique Kerber. So let's get the job done. Billie Jean K9, the dog, is back in town, or certainly back in Catherine's flat. She there at the moment? Sounds very quiet.
She's at daycare today. She's being trialled at a new daycare.
Right.
Ooh, as in she's on trial, not the daycare, apparently.
They've heard the stories.
Yeah.
They've heard about the leads. They've got a lot of nice wiring there at the new daycare that needs looking after.
She's grown. She's matured since then.
Got to prove herself. She's sponsored by Billie Jean King, who's got her book out at the moment called All In, which is out in the US now, and it's coming out in the UK soon as well. It is the autobiography of Billie Jean King.
Mm.
I do not need to say anything more.
I've started just reading it.
Go and get it.
Just go and get it, yeah.
Yes. Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer, as well as being our US Open relived editor for one of our shows next week. I can't wait. Can we do all this now? Because I want to do it now. No. All right. Okay, well, we'll do it next week. And we'll be back with you in a few days' time, looking back on Cincinnati. Thanks for your company. We'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.